One of my favorite destinations is China. It is just a wonderful, wonderful country. It's a country that sometimes can assault the senses, but it is one place that everyone should visit at least once in their lives. One guy that's been traveling around China for quite some time now is Wade Shepherd. Wade has a website, vagabondjourney.com, which is one that I've been following for quite some time. And he has also written a book on the ghost cities of China. This is really unbelievable. I'm going to get Wade to tell you about it. Wade, hi, how are you going?
Hey, Steve, how are you doing?
Now, I believe as we speak, you are in the lovely little city of Xiamen, which is on the southeast coast of China.
Yep, that is correct. I have a little apartment right on the beach, and I can see Taiwan's Jinmen Island right across the strait. So it's a pretty nice place to be.
Isn't it unusual to think that here you are, you can see Taiwan, and yet there is really not much interaction between where you are, Xiamen, and the island that you can see?
Yeah, cross-strait relations are becoming a lot more active recently, like within the past few years. Traditionally speaking, Jinmen Island and Xiamen Island kind of always went together. I mean, they're only separated by like 3 kilometers of water. So they're always like these like major trade hubs, right? During China's like international trade. Well, same country, different system, or two countries, whatever you want to say it.
Or whatever the Chinese want to say.
Yeah, whatever they want to say. I mean, Taiwan claims all of China. China claims Taiwan. They both think they're the legitimate Chinese government. Oh, whatever. There's just this fascinating interplay between like the two political places that are the two political units that are happening right across the strait, right across these two islands, and they're becoming kind of connected again. Like in Xiamen, Xiamen's full of Taiwanese businessmen, you know, and Taiwan is becoming full of Chinese businessmen, and like in the name of business cross straits communication, and the countries are kind of joining together, at least economically speaking in recent years. And it's kind of interesting to see they're doing these like cross straits art festivals and cross straits canoe races and stuff like that, and they're actually like want to build a bridge between Xiamen and Jinmen Island soon. Yeah, Chinese are starting to build it, but it's like it's still a political, a little bit of a political mess.
But, I think so. It'd be interesting to find out what the toll is if they do build it, because I got an idea that the Taiwanese will have to pay a lot more than the Chinese if they cross it. Now, we weren't going to talk about Xiamen, but now that you're there, I think I've mentioned to you that it is the honeymoon capital of China as well. So no doubt you're seeing happy couples walking hand to hand along the street.
Yep. Yeah, the beaches are full of women in full bridal gowns, like standing in the waves and getting like muddy sand all over them. So it's a happy place. But I mean if you can call a beach full of 100 people getting their wedding pictures taken at the same time a happy place. I mean, they actually bring horses out on the beach to take pictures of like you know, people and brides and grooms like riding horses on the beach, you know.
Well, I have to tell you a little story about I am actually in many, many wedding photos up there in China, because years ago, back in the 80s, I used to take tour groups there. Now, I'm a rather large chap, and I look like the Laughing Buddha. Now, the Laughing Buddha is a very good symbol for the Chinese. It represents wealth, and it represents happiness. And I would go walking through the parks where in those days they used to go for their wedding photos, and they would see me, and they would come up, and they would touch my stomach for good luck, and they would always pose for photos. So I've been all these wedding photos up there. I have no idea whose weddings they were, by the way, but I'm sure that there's on the walls of all these Chinese families, there's me with the wedding group. They're probably thinking, "Oh, look, Laughing Buddha, there he is, walking along."
Too bad they didn't give you money like they do to the Laughing Buddha in the temples.
What a way, fake money, because that's what they give them in the temples as well. I'm going to talk to you about your new book, which is called The Ghost Cities of China. Now, this is an incredible thing, and you're going to set us right, because I've heard about the ghost cities, which are cities that have been built mainly for future purposes that are almost empty these days. And there's quite a few of them there in China, isn't there, Wade?
Quite literally, there's hundreds of them. I mean, the central government even has a hard time counting them. And in 2013, last year, they did a survey of only 14 provinces, and they figured out that they're building 200 completely new towns within only like half the provinces in the entire country. So how many of these places that are being built nationwide? I mean, it's anybody's guess.
That's amazing, isn't it? There must be a reason why they're building them, and there must be a reason why they're building them now. Did you ever find that out?
Yeah, it's just part of their long-range urbanization push and transforming China from an export economy to more of a domestic consumption economy. And the premise is that people who live in cities consume more, which is a fact. China, I mean, during the early years of China's reform and opening policy, I mean, the country was looking outwards to export products to drive their economy from purchases overseas and in international business. And then with the recent economic downturn, like 2009, the one before it, in like 1998, it kind of shook China. Kind of shook the Communist Party, because they kind of realized how insecure of an economic platform relying on exports really is. Because, yeah. I mean, a ripple in the U.S. economy, or the ripple in the European economy, becomes a tidal wave once it gets to China, because China was dependent on, you know, a foreign enterprise for financial sustenance. So part of this urbanization movement is more of a long-range goal to kind of turn China's economic focus inward in a way. It's kind of like a way of like putting a new Great Wall around the country, trying to make the country more economically resilient to vacillations in the global economy by developing a massive consumer market. So rather than shipping all their products overseas, they ship them around their own country, which is very large and very diverse and has a good amount of natural resources still.
It's an amazing change, because when I first went there, I mean, the thing that we used to visit communes, and the majority of people outside of the cities, and even in the cities. I mean, I went to communes in some of the bigger cities as well. But that was all a communal thing, and there was no such thing as individual wealth or individual ownership. Now they have turned completely 180 degrees, and now they want people to own properties, and they want people to have wealth, because they realize that wealth is actually good for the country.
Well, it did turn 180 degrees. Yeah, I mean the country just reeks of money and riches and well a large portion of it. I mean there's a larger middle class in China now than the entire population of the United States. And they've this capitalistic experiment that they started running is spread across the whole society almost, and it's kind of running out of control. But on the other side, that China still has like 800 million poor people too. So they still have this massive supply of like cheap labor, right? So on one hand, they have like 400 million middle class and upper class people, like way bigger than the population of the USA. And then on the other hand, they still have this massive underclass too. So I mean, it's kind of like the creation of like an entire world within one country.
That's right. Now, getting back to some of these cities, I'm assuming that they are very modern cities. I'm assuming that, you know, they're not cheaply built or anything. I'm assuming that they're being built with all the modern facilities that you would expect to find in a city. Is that correct?
That's what they're being sold as. I mean, there's different kinds of new cities. There's kind of these benchmark eco cities and benchmark like futuristic cities where they clear out like an entire expanse of land and they try to build these conceptual like urban design projects that the world has never seen before. And then there's the other side of that, which is more common, is just like pretty much these crudely constructed like new districts and new areas where they just throw up. I mean, they sell land to developers. Local governments sell land to developers, and they throw up just like massive seas of these cheaply built high rises and just these generic cities that are going up on the outskirts of pretty much every sizable urban center in the country. So it's really both. It's really, I mean, they're really like playing both sides of the coin here, as far as like new experimentation and new advanced cities, and you know, the same old generic city.
Did you have any problems getting access to these places or not?
No, not at all. No, I mean, especially no political problems, no police problems. In the West, we kind of like, I mean, the ghost cities are kind of sold as being like this political problem, as being these political failures and something that the Chinese government is embarrassed about, something that the local governments are ashamed of, but they're not. I mean, these are places that the local governments flaunt. Yeah, you know, these are like the trophies on the trophy cases of like the local officials. officials, they're proud of these places. They put a lot of resources in these places, and they want to bring people into these new cities.
So it's sort of come and live and work here, and this is what we can provide to you. It's a boast for them.
Yeah. And then the way these new cities are designed, well, I'm talking about like the ones that are meant to be the benchmark cities, the ones that they want to talk about, ones that they want to show off, the bigger ghost cities that we know of. They design them from like the center out. So they're going to clear out a massive expanse of land, clear everybody off of it, just completely like grade the whole thing, knock everything out, and then they build up these urban centers, right? But so they build up the skyscrapers, they build these malls, and they build their own central business districts and whatever. I mean, they really like models at first, right? They're models to like show investors, show off to other government officials, whatever, of what this place will be like in the future. They're not actually like, you can't actually live in them yet, because they don't have all the facilities that you need to live somewhere, right? So they build the more showcase things first, and then they add on like hospitals and schools later as people start to move in. When we talk about China's ghost cities, I mean, what we're really talking about is like a phase of development,
right?
And in the creation of what will more than likely, most of the big ones will more than likely become normal, regular cities. Okay. And this whole ghost city thing will probably fade from view. The ghost city is a phenomenon is really more or less just a phase between like the building of the central part of the city and the city actually coming alive, because it's a chicken and the egg scenario. You know, nobody's going to really move into a city where there's nothing, and like businesses and hospitals and like the government's not going to make complex urban transportation networks if there's no people. So it's like this like interim period where people like start to dribble in, and eventually these places become what I found, these places become populated and they become real cities, and we don't really talk about them as ghost cities anymore.
Normally for a city outside of, say, capital cities, which are obviously usually highly developed, things like Washington, D.C. and Canberra here in Australia. But most cities, they just sort of grow over time. But I guess the main difference here is the cities that you're talking about, they are pretty much perfectly planned. So they have their template, they build it, and then the people move in into something that has already been planned. I suppose in most cases it's not a bad little urban development, because the way they've been able to build it is they've been able to build it in an unfettered way with residents who, without the residents already there, arguing or complaining about what they're doing.
That's true to a large extent. I mean, part of the reason why they're building these ghost cities is because like the historic Chinese city, especially what has been built between like 1949 and the early 90s. I mean, these cities are a mess. Like a lot of these cities are like really, really ancient places that have been being like developed and redeveloped and over and over and over again. There's like these real like patchworks of like urbanity, or these patchwork urban systems that when you add like, you know, millions and millions of cars and on highways, they don't really work very well anymore. So part of like building these new cities is to say, hey, we have this massive urban problem here and we need to fix this. Now we can either fix it by going through and completely knocking down the cities that we have and rebuilding them to be adequate for like the modern world. Or we can like go over here to this area and clear out an area that's as big as the city we already have and build a new city from scratch. We can build it on singular conceptions and like have like macro urban design plans and try to make these idealized urban attempt to make these little urban utopias that are adequate for like the modern age and, you know, for people who drive cars.
And that's sort of exactly what they did in Shanghai. When I first went to Shanghai, Pudong was agricultural area, but of course now it's one of the most amazing and certainly one of the most sophisticated urban centers in the world.
That's true. I mean, yeah. I mean, the CBD in Pudong, what you see when you look across the Huangpu River from old Shanghai. I mean, that was China's first ghost city. I mean, like economists, like foreign economists and journalists, like, oh yeah, look at this ghost city, you know, and China's building stuff they don't need, but it's just not a ghost city anymore. The Shanghai government flipped a switch. They made a lot of the SOEs, state-owned enterprise, moved over. I say now. this area is ready to be populated. So they sent people over there, and now nobody's going to call. You know, you have to be really incredibly stupid to call the CBD a Pudong a ghost city now, right? But it took a good 10 years after or so after it appeared to be built for this to happen. You don't build a city. I mean, be cliche here. I mean, Rome wasn't built in a day. You know, and these are more like long range plans that the Chinese have for these places. And as far as making comments on them being populated or not populated, now it's a lot of times it's too early to tell.
And I suppose also they've had their one child policy for, well, many decades now. So I guess that with that one child policy, their population isn't going to grow at such a high rate. So I guess these cities that they're building are not so much for future generations, but for the generation that is there now that really want to go on and have a more established life in a more modern city, I assume.
That is true. I mean, a lot of these new districts and new cities, they're basically not really being built. A lot of times they're not really being built for like urban migrants, people coming in from the countryside to move into the city. They're more being built for the country's existing urban middle class who want to upgrade their housing, their living standard. They want to upgrade the places that they live to move out to.
And the Chinese have always been pretty good at copying things. I remember Shanghai, for instance. Shanghai used to be divided in four. You had the English Quarter and the French Quarter, etc. And when you go to these areas, it is like when you go to the English Quarter, it is like going to a little bit of England. Yeah, the mm-hmm. architecture is the same. When you go to the French Quarter, it is like going, say, to Paris or somewhere. It's all the same. Are they doing that there? Do they have a specific sort of style that they have for these new cities? Or do they just play with it as they go sort of thing?
Well, architecturally speaking, I mean, China's going through a really interesting phase of like experimentation. I mean, they're trying like new cutting edge, like futuristic kind of like urban designs, and then they're also like borrowing styles from like England and France and whatnot, and they're creating these like hodgepodge cities with like many different like architectural styles as they slowly develop what will eventually become the new Chinese standard of architecture. But right now it's really amazing because they're trying everything. Like every government official wants their like benchmark project that's going to stand out and impress people. So like they're really, really, really trying to like not only build these places for like functional purposes, but also to impress, they're monuments. Like a lot of these new cities are monuments and they're full of monumentality. So yeah, they're just using all kinds of different like architectural styles and new building methods and a lot of things to stand out. And in a lot of ways, yeah, it is like old Shanghai, like a lot of like foreign powers were there, but the Chinese would copy the foreign styles, and it became blended into like this weird like Art Deco kind of style and a real hodgepodge of like architecture, which is pretty interesting.
Now, Wade, Ghost Cities of China, how can people get hold of the book?
It's being published by Zed Books out of London. As part of their Asian Arguments series. You can buy it on Amazon when it comes out, and you could also, you can also get it in probably like college bookstores or places like that.
Okay. Now your website, vagabondjourney.com, you've had that up for a long time, haven't you? You've been mm-hmm. traveling. I mean, last time I spoke to you, you were living in Mexico, but that was a couple of years ago. And I've been following you, and I think you've been to Indonesia and a few other places since then, but mainly in China, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. Now, I wouldn't say I settled down, but I have a wife and a daughter, and we kind of made a little home for ourselves in China for the past 2.5 years.
Well, if you're going to make a home in China, I think Xiamen is one of the better places because it's sort of fairly laid back. It's got that sort of holiday atmosphere there, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's nice. I mean, I live right on the beach in kind of a newly developed part of the city, and it's not too crowded, and it's really nice. But I mean, the last time we talked, we were in Mexico. We were kind of just like backpacking and traveling around as a family, which is kind of cool when you have like a little baby or a little kid. You can just put it in the baby carrier and take it wherever you want to. But then my daughter's like 4.5 years old now, and it became time to kind of decide if we wanted to just keep traveling and just keep taking like a brief glimpses at places, or if we really wanted to settle down and, like, you know, I could develop, like, expertise in the place as far as, like, can develop as, like, a writer or an author, and my wife could actually have, like, a real job. You know, she's a Montessori teacher, you know, really learn languages and, like, really learn culture and, like, really learn something. And it just kind of happened. It wasn't really intentional. And we just, I mean, I've always liked China. I've been coming back. I've been coming here since 2005. And then, I mean, it wasn't really, we didn't really plan that. We just kind of showed up and stayed. I mean, life is, once you get into, like, the routine of China, I mean, life can be very, very comfortable.
I reckon it's a great destination, a great place. Mm-hmm. Wade Shepherd, author of Ghost Cities of China, and also who has the website vagabondjourney.com. Thanks very much for speaking to me again. I've really enjoyed it. It's great to catch up with you again, Wade.
Yeah, it was great talking to you again, Steve.